Hello and welcome to this podcast from the Child Protection in Sport Unit. We're part of the NSPCC and funded by UK Sports Councils. Our work supports organisations to safeguard all children taking part in sport.
Hello, welcome to this podcast from the Child Protection in Sport Unit. My name's Jude and I'm one of the senior consultants at the unit. Today we're going to talk about how sports organisations manage their safeguarding concerns. We have a case management tool on our site, the cpsu.org.uk, which gives information about each of the stages of an effective case management process. But we know that each organisation will need to develop their own procedure in line with the particular structures and activities of the body. And with this in mind, I'm very pleased to be joined by Nancy Squires from British Canoeing, Keith Eldridge from British Judo, and Gordon Valentine from England Boxing. And we're going to find out more about how they manage cases in their sports. It would be great if we could start by hearing a little about your own backgrounds and a brief overview of safeguarding in each of your sports. So if I could start with you, Nancy.
Thanks, June. Good to be here. So I'm the head of governance at British Canoeing. I'm a lawyer by practice, and I also hold the role of designated safeguarding lead within the organisation. So I have overall responsibility for safeguarding. I'm assisted by a great team, and we all have different roles to play within safeguarding fields. So we have a designated safeguarding case officer who is responsible for day-to-day management of cases. We have a legal and governance officer who supports policy and procedure development and ensures alignment within our disciplinary processes and safeguarding procedures with legal requirements. We also have a safeguarding and compliance officer who works in the more proactive side of safeguarding, so supporting clubs and discipline committees with safeguarding framework development, delivering training, policies and procedures and templates, and providing advice to clubs on how they can improve best practice within a club environment. We also have a performance wellbeing coach who works within the performance team, supporting our elite and talent athletes, being a confidant to speak to, supporting any athletes who might be involved in safeguarding cases, but also providing a lot of training and support around supporting mental health within the programmes, and also supporting those coaches in terms of what best practice looks like when it might come to one-to-one coaching arrangements, and supporting welfare and wellbeing within the WorkCast programme. And then finally, we have an equality, diversity and inclusion lead who works across the organisation. And then within our clubs and discipline committees, we seek to have two club welfare officers who will manage concerns and cases and safeguarding practices within the club and committee structure. And then I would say over the last year or so, we've had around 43 cases. I would say that's fewer than typical, likely reflective of the limits to activity due to the pandemic. Concerns come to us in a variety of ways, certainly at club level, typically reported to us by the club welfare officer, but we will pick up cases through communication from statutory agencies, direct concerns from young people or parents, or through coaches too. And so that's a bit of an overview really of how we manage things within the canoeing world.
That's really useful to hear. And it's a very comprehensive safeguarding team within canoeing. How does that compare with British Judo, Keith?
It makes me quite envious, really. We do all those things, but there's me part-time and my deputy part-time. My background's in policing. I was a detective chief inspector on a murder team in South London. And previous to that, I'd worked on serious sexual allegations as well. So I had lead for British Judo on investigations, but as the lead safeguarding officer, I do most of those things that Nancy's got other people doing for her, so I'm very envious. So I look at our policy, rewrite our policy, update that every year or more frequently if needed. I do the risk management part of positive DBSs, and I give advice on a sort of a day-to-day basis. My deputy, she leads on club welfare officers, the actual DBS administration, training and admin. Like Nancy, we had a fairly reduced caseload this last year, around about 40, 42 cases, which is about half of what we'd normally get in a year. But obviously, clubs haven't been able to practice for quite a few months of the last year. I think it's quite interesting about who records what. I mean, we made a decision in British Judo that if someone just asks us for general advice, perhaps they're planning a trip, we'll give them advice and point them to useful stuff like on the CPSU website. There's some really good stuff there for that sort of thing. But we won't record that as anything. We'll just give that advice out. If they're looking for advice about something that's happened, maybe there was an argument at the club last night and a parent was shouting at a child or something like that, then we will record that as an advice given case, because history's shown us that they're the sort of ones that might come back in a week's time, a month's time, if there's an escalation. So it's useful just to have that recorded from the outset.
Thanks very much, Keith. And I think there'll be a lot of governing bodies who will share your envy of British Canoeing's structure. But it does illustrate how different governing bodies are needing to adapt case management systems to their own structures. And Gordon, you must have some particular considerations in boxing as well.
Yes, particularly around sparring. Sparring is a big issue for us. It's a very heavily regulated part of our sport. This also can be a safeguarding concern. We've had instances where boxers are mismatched and some in sparring, and sometimes that's used as a punishment. We have a few instances of those. The other thing, particular considerations we have, is weight loss, because you have weight categories within boxing. The tendency is that boxers try to lose a bit of weight to get in particular weight categories, and that is quite a significant issue, especially if you're dehydrating or getting a boxer to train when they're in a dehydrated state, and especially with children. Another thing I might mention with boxing is that 40% of our clubs are in the 20% highest socially deprived areas. And we are very much recognised as a sport that is used to keep disadvantaged kids off the streets, and also a second chance sport for people who have drifted into criminality. And this may have an impact on our safeguarding through our DBS process. There is a theory that we have a higher proportion of people who have content on the DBS. So we pay particular interest or particular care that this DBS risk assessment process is very, very good, because finding that balance between being a second chance sport and not taking any risk with safeguarding can be a bit of a tricky area.
Thank you, Gordon. It's very interesting to hear about how you've adapted your case management process to the particular needs of the sport. Now, I know that all of you have case management groups, so I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about the membership of the group and the kind of concerns it addresses. And Keith, I wonder if you could kick us off with this.
Yeah, until recently, all of our case management group were actually employees of British Judo, and a review quite rightly recognised that kind of lacked independence. So about a year ago now, we've now got, it was five, but it's now down to four independent members that are just volunteers. So when a case comes in, I'll refer it to them. If we're going to look at suspension, it should be two independent members and one staff member. We look at it as a group. And then when a case is finished, I'll do some recommendations as to how I think it should proceed. And again, it'll go to two independent members and one staff member of that group for a decision. The background of these people are mostly social work and police officers, former police officers, and one current police officer.
Thanks, Keith. Gordon, how does the group work within boxing?
The case management group is made up of people who are independent of the organisation, and they all have a professional safeguarding background. And they're mostly made up of lawyers, ex-senior police officers, and current safeguarding professionals. And they are selected on a case-to-case basis. So we have a great degree of independence and speciality. The only slight exception to that is we, with our DBS risk assessment, we do have a standing committee, but they are an independent committee.
It's interesting to hear the importance of independence and specialisms there, both from Keith and Gordon. Is that similar for you in canoeing, Nancy?
Yes, Jude. In terms of having independence within the group management system, yes, we do. Our case management group is made up of a chair who is an independent safeguarding consultant. And then currently we have 7 voluntary independent members with different backgrounds, always in safeguarding, but some from health and social care. We also have 4 police officers and social workers that make up that group. And then I sit on that group too. We meet bi-monthly and consider a broad range of concerns and cases that we manage. I would say I think we have quite a low threshold for cases to be considered by the group. We are fortunate in having that expertise, and they are a very they're really keen to be involved and great at responding to us. So we do bring most cases to that group. Our safeguarding procedure does have an initial level of triage with our safeguarding consultant, so the chair of the group. So any concern that we have, we would always triage and have an initial discussion about. Once we've ascertained the basic facts of the case around what the concern seems to be, what our plan of action is for next steps, and to agree whether or not we consider it to be a case for the case management group. In terms of DBS cases, the group does have oversight and sees all of the DBS cases, but to make sure that process is quite effective and timely, the chair of our group, of the group, and me as designated safeguarding lead for the organisation are empowered to determine the outcome of those cases. So there is just a bit of scrutiny by the wider group, but the decisions are just made by myself and the chair. And then if there's a particularly complex DBS or we don't agree on the outcome, then that goes to our full CMG for consideration.
It's interesting you mentioned the lower thresholds for bringing cases to the full group. And that brings us onto the issue of low-level concerns, also referred to as poor practice issues. We know that challenging this type of concern is an important part of creating a safer environment. But how do you handle those, Nancy?
Yeah, so I mean, I think it's interesting when you ask about low-level concerns and understanding and exactly what we mean by those. Sometimes we're talking about examples of maybe poor practicing or poor coaching, which might verge on, say, bullying or just feel inappropriate. And I think they're quite difficult to manage in terms of making sure you've got the resources and organisation to support that. If it's a coach, say that coach, in improving that practice and looking out for what training you can give. And I think, you know, mentoring is a great thing, but really quite difficult to resource. Those concerns we try to have as open a conversation and try to make those conversations positive with those individuals that are of concern. Then I think when we also talk about low-level concerns, we have examples of perhaps behaviours that indicate the potential of very serious concerns, but actually in and of themselves wouldn't be sufficient for you to necessarily be instigating any significant sanctions or bans, but there is a niggling concern there that you have that this might be evidence of a much bigger problem or bigger concern. The Larry Nassar case, for example, whilst that could obviously have been handled much better throughout many of the procedures, actually that arose by some concerns that you think that doesn't feel quite right. I think with those concerns, they are really challenging because you have an awareness that this could lead to something that will be really serious, really significant, have a huge impact on the young people and wider. And you can only work with the evidence that you presented, and also investigating those can be really sensitive. You know, how do you manage that without creating a bigger problem, without escalating the concerns too far? So I think for those, it is about having a robust investigation, making sure you've covered everything that you stop and check and challenge yourself all the way along that investigation process to see, is there more we could do? How are we handling communication? And then reflecting on it and trying to have some measures in there for continual review and check and follow up. So there's enough awareness that the behaviours that have come to you, they're not acceptable. And to encourage that reporting of concerns amongst the community and people that are aware perhaps of this individual. So that if something in the future does come up, I think, A, you've got a defensible position to say we did everything we could reasonably do to stop this happening at these when we were aware of these low-level concerns. But B, that if something more significant does happen or there is more significant evidence that people will come to you with those disclosures and you'll be able to take action.
You raised some really important points there, and I think we hear increasingly that from all governing bodies, the low-level concern, the poor practices are sometimes the most challenging. And Gordon and Keith, I'm sure you've got your own comments. Gordon, shall I hand over to you first? Anything to add to what Nancy's saying?
Yeah, yes, it's difficult, isn't it, at early stage, whether it's a low-level concern or not. We want all safeguarding incidents to be reported, something quite adequately dealt with within the club by the club welfare officer. But if they're reported and they come through, we can have oversight of them to satisfy ourselves that was the right decision in the first place. But also it gives us information on trends or things that might be happening throughout the sport that we need to have education and might be learning needs over them. So we want them all reported.
Absolutely. Keith, anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, I mean, picking up on a couple of things that people have mentioned, poor practice, poor coaching. At the bottom end, it could be about weight management. It could be about name calling, shouting at the kids on the mat. That's very easily creeping into bullying. So they are things that we need to know about. And particularly if we've got multiple reports of the same coaches doing some of those poor things. Quite often what I like to do, we've got development staff that work nationally, or we did have, we've cut down on them, unfortunately, because of the problems at the moment. And I'd get them just to do one of their regular visits, just to have a look at how a coaching session's going, but with that knowledge in the background that we've had a complaint about something, perhaps it's that the coach loses his temper or something. And they'll just do a visit and see what happens there as part of their day-to-day sort of work, and then they report back to me, and then I can decide whether or not we need to work more with the coach or whether I can just have a quick chat with him. Club welfare officers I see as really useful as their eyes and ears at club level. You know, we can make all the best policies in the world, but you know, we can't be visiting every single club to ensure that they're happening right. So for me, that's the role of the club welfare officer, as their eyes and ears at club level, and then reporting anything like that to us.
I think you've highlighted the importance of addressing some of these low-level concerns early to prevent them escalating into something more serious. Also, you all talked a little bit about investigation. So when it comes to an investigation, who would carry that out? And what does investigation really mean? So Keith and Gordon, you're both experienced former police officers, and I'm going to ask you first. Gordon, I wondered if you've got any thoughts about investigations.
Well, investigation, of course, is when you seek out every bit of knowledge about the incident from every possible source. And mostly, in the cases I deal with, it's witnesses, but you can have physical evidence like CCTV. But that has got to be proportionate to the matter you're dealing with. I mean, instances of poor practice are dealt with by club welfare officers, but when they become a significant concern, they come to the centre and invariably dealt with by myself and sometimes by a regional safeguarding officer.
So you would lead on the majority of the investigation sidings. Would that be similar for you, Keith?
Yeah, absolutely. I do all of our investigations currently, although we have got a separate complaints and conduct group who are all volunteers who I could call on if I needed to for a particularly big case if we had a lot of witnesses. But in my experience so far, and I've been doing the job for 8 or 9 years now, the bigger jobs usually have been via the police anyway. So statements would have been obtained by the police. And I'm a great believer in getting the police to share that information. Not always easy, But if you persist and you say the right things, usually, you know, with the consent of the person who's written the statement, you can get all the statements and you save yourself an awful lot of time. So on the bigger cases, on the smaller cases, it's not so difficult. You can talk to people and get your own statements. I think people panic a little bit when they hear the word investigation sometimes. And I think, as Gordon says, all an investigation is trying to see what happened. So it's about speaking to witnesses, looking for other corroboration in whatever way you can. Is there anything that supports the allegation? But equally, is there anything that undermines the allegation? Just because someone's saying something happened doesn't mean to say it did happen. There might be other motives for the making that allegation. So important to look at both sides of it and look at the investigation in the round.
Absolutely. I think you're right. I think a lot of people get quite intimidated by the term investigation. And Nancy, you've got a safeguarding case officer. So do they take on most of the investigation work in canoeing themselves?
Yeah, so our safeguarding case management officer, she is a former police officer herself, and will undertake most of the investigation work in any cases. I think, like Keith alluded to, often the more significant and serious the concern, the easier the investigation from our perspective is, because the police statutory agencies will be responsible for most of that. And actually there isn't as much work involved in that stage for us. So our safeguarding case officer, she will investigate most of the cases. We do from time to time use independent investigators, either if the case is particularly complex or large in terms of number of witnesses and we might not have the capacity to deal with it, then we might look to instruct an independent investigator. But also if we have cases where perhaps the individual of concern would be a member of staff, or particularly if it was a senior member of staff, then there might be reasons there where we would want some independence in that investigation. So we might have the time, the capacity to manage that case, but for the confidence of those involved, it's more appropriate for that to be contracted on an independent basis. I think some of the challenge and trickiness we have in that is finding an investigator. We have worked with a couple of really good ones, but they are busy, they can't always do it. And beyond that, it's hard to know who you might be able to use. And I do think that's something that perhaps sports could work together more on, in terms of having a bit of bank of people, because there's probably a lot of sports that don't need to use investigator all that often, but we'll need to use one from time to time. And to have someone who we know gets safeguarding in sport and is kind of recommended by, you know, trusted colleagues, and that would be really useful.
Yes, I really like that idea, Nancy. I think it will be great for collaboration across governing bodies. I know that sometimes you'll be liaising with statutory agencies as well. We've talked about how low-level concerns can be managed, and the other side of the threshold is looking at statutory agencies such as local authority designated officers, children's services, or the police. So who takes this on, and does it raise any challenges? I'll ask Gordon first.
Yeah, yes, invariably they're dealt with by this safeguarding lead, they're dealt with by myself. The concern I have, which Keith has just touched on earlier, is that occasions where you're dealing with a safeguarding incident and it might have happened outside of the environment of your sport, and you get drawn into a local authority meeting with it because the person is invariably a coach within your sport. You go through a process, and sometimes it's very difficult for the police. A failed prosecution, the threshold of proof beyond reasonable doubt is so high, and the case fails. And then there's a safeguarding concern, and it's then passed on to the national governing body to make a decision whether that person is safe or not to take part in regulatory activity. And sometimes you're just left with a set of minutes. And it's very difficult sometimes to get further information sharing. And sometimes it's very difficult because you present a set of minutes to a professional safeguarding panel and there's questions to be asked. I think the information sharing in these situations, I think, is very poor and very unclear. And that's the biggest frustration for myself by far.
That does sound frustrating. Do you have any similar experiences, Nancy?
Yeah, absolutely. I think probably the best word I'd use to describe information sharing, certainly over the last few years, is inconsistent, and that we've worked with some police officers and forces and some LADOs that have been really helpful, shared information, worked with us, been really supportive. And then at the other end of the scale, we've had, you know, complete lack or refusal to share information. We've also had situations where club welfare officers have been asked to essentially fulfill social services' role in undertaking assessments, speaking with parents where there's concerns about neglect, and just kind of feel like they've been left completely unsupported. So I certainly feel that there's a level of inconsistency, but it is always difficult with working with little information but feeling like you hold a lot of the risk. And I think sometimes it is about doing as much as you can. And if you feel that your work or your risk management procedures have been impacted by lack of information sharing, to really put that back onto the statutory agencies to say, you know, you have a responsibility and a duty towards the community too. And we can't do X, Y, and Z because of the lack of information sharing, and making sure that you make that point very clearly, I think is really important.
Yeah, it's very, very important, Nancy. Thanks. And I'm sure you've got plenty to add to that, Keith, as well.
Yeah, I think the LADO is a really useful friend, actually. And I'm finding over the last year or two that they're becoming more aware of the existence of people like ourselves as lead safeguarding officers. Going back a couple of years, they had no idea that sports were employing people like us. So quite often they'd invite the club welfare officer to go along to a strategy meeting, and you'd only find out about it through the club welfare officer. But now they do come direct to us quite quickly. It's quite bizarre. I mean, I've dealt with one particular team in a county force. One officer gave me probably too much. And then the next officer on a new case, about 9 months now, I'll keep on asking him, well, when can we talk? I don't want anything I shouldn't have, and this is what I need it for. And I still haven't got it. But what I do in those cases is get the LADO as a real good friend, because the LADO will share what information they've got, which is normally more than you've been given, but will also encourage the police and know which is the senior officer within that team to go to actually get things moving. So I've found the LADO really, really helpful on that sort of side of things.
Some useful tips there, because some LADOs don't really understand how sports safeguarding works. And I know that the CPSU has got a link with the National LADO Network to contact if you have any queries about information sharing or liaison with LADOs. Keith?
Yeah, just one other thing I think is another useful little tip is that you can get people to apply for their own statements. They're entitled to a copy of their statement, and I've used that quite often, and we'll pay for it. But again, it's saving an awful lot of time and energy if you just get them to make a data request for their statement.
That's really useful. And I would encourage lead officers within governing bodies to talk to one another and get some of these tips. When making decisions about concerns, what process do you have in place to ensure that they are robust and defensible? Nancy?
I think in terms of the internal expertise and experience that we have, myself having legal experience and having worked in the safeguarding sector for many years, we do bring a range of extensive experience in terms of that day-to-day management of cases and decision-making. We have a robust safeguarding procedure. It's reviewed every 2 years, and we follow that procedure in every single case. And that includes a requirement that all cases that go to the CMG for advice. Again, that group has a great range of experience and expertise in safeguarding and are responsible for determining the outcome of the cases. I think my role as designated safeguarding lead, working for British Canoeing, but also sitting on the group, does ensure that there is a link between the assessment of the case within the case management group and independent expertise, but also adjoining that up to the organisation, so that any steps taken or sanctions issued can be implemented, that they're practical, and that they are joined up with the aims of the organisation. We obviously ensure that all our actions taken, so that's discussions, telephone calls, emails, case management group minutes, that they're all recorded contemporaneously on case files, The CMG also have access to these files in time for every meeting, so they get to read the whole case and refer back to any documents or evidence that they need to. And then we also have a member of staff who sits in the coaching team, but provides a bit of support for individuals who are subject to safeguarding investigations or concerns. And that's proved helpful in some cases. I think perhaps in terms of supporting the victim, we're lacking in that. And I think it's lacking in support generally. But that's something that I'd certainly like to introduce to the way we manage cases in the future.
Yes, I think the support for the victim is definitely an area for the development of sport sector. I'd agree with that. Keith, anything that you have to add to what Nancy said?
Yeah, I think along the formal lines, I think pretty much what Nancy said, you know, we can go to the case management group. Where needed, we'll go to outside lawyers for legal advice if we think that's necessary. But I think it's also good to remember that informally, that there are our colleagues. So quite often Gordon and I will work together on something because we're both contact sports that have got weight groups. So there's lots of similarities there. So sometimes I'll ask him and maybe another sport or another organisation to review a problematic case where we can't get it resolved. So the CPSU can help you. The Ancraft Trust has helped us review cases before when it's involved an adult. I'm a member of the Sports Resolutions National Safeguarding Panel, so people I've worked with on that, I can go to them for an informal chat, or if need be, we can go to them at an official level. So I think it's the lead safeguarding officer days that the CPSU run a really useful networking day to actually speak to colleagues and make friends with people and use them to bounce ideas off. And when you're not sure what to do about something, there's always someone there that, and quite often if you go to the CPSU and say, I've got a problem with X, Y or Z, they'll say, oh yeah, that sport has dealt with that recently, and put you in touch with somebody. So there's always someone out there that you can talk these things through with on an informal level, as well as those formal ones that Nancy spoke of.
That's very reassuring, particularly for less experienced safeguarding lead officers, I think. Gordon, anything you'd like to add there?
Yeah, I agree. There is a lot of help and support out there, both formal and informal. But with the robust decision making, we have, I think we've got a fairly good system. All our significant cases are dealt with by a safeguarding review panel, which come out with written findings and sometimes comment on safeguarding procedures, you know, beyond the actual case, and all the final decisions are overseen by our safeguarding subcommittee. So they're reviewed and see if there's anything needs to be implemented from those cases. It's not a bad system.
That's good to hear. So we've talked about decision making, and we're going to move on to talk about outcomes. So what kind of outcomes do you take as a result of safeguarding and child protection concerns? I'd like to explore, would your case management group take disciplinary decisions, or would that be the remit of a different group? I'll start with you, Gordon. What's your process in boxing?
Yeah, our safeguarding review panels can make orders or conditions appropriate to safeguarding children, including barring them from the sport. They also have the option of referring them to the disciplinary procedure, which would be another committee that oversees the disciplinary process. I mean, the safeguarding review panel secure the safeguarding needs of that situation, and that may or may not have a punitive effect on the person who's the accused. It may have a punitive effect. He might get barred from the sport. If the safeguarding review panel feel that there should be a punitive measure, it's then transferred to the disciplinary panel. And this works both ways. Disciplinary panels can refer things to safeguarding panels, and safeguarding panels can refer them to disciplinary panels.
So it's interesting to see that kind of relationship between the two groups. How does that compare to canoeing, Nancy?
Yeah, as I say, similar. Under our safeguarding process, the case management group's empowered to impose a range of sanctions, but I would say they are in relation to I guess, risk management. So is this individual safe, you know, to work with children or to be around children or young people? And then you put measures in if that isn't the case, whether that's training, suspension of activity with under 18s, suspension of membership or club suspension. But that would always be from a risk management point of view rather than a punitive point of view. One of the things the case management group can do is to recommend that disciplinary action is considered by British Canoeing. So that would be a completely separate process. We have a different group of volunteers that, you know, primarily legally qualified volunteers that consider disciplinary cases. I would say there might also be cases where safeguarding sanctions wouldn't be sufficient. So, for example, if it involved a member of staff, then there would need to be an HR disciplinary process instigated. And there might also be other sanctions that the disciplinary process itself could invoke that would be appropriate for cases. So, yeah, there are two separate processes, I would say. The large proportion of our cases are resolved just by the safeguarding procedure itself and don't proceed to disciplinary action.
Is this similar in judo, Keith?
Yeah, very much so. Picking up on what Nancy was saying there, for me, it's about risk management. Is this coach safe to be coaching in judo? So at the lower end, quite often it would be words of advice that might need some more training. At the top end, though, is where I think there's the most risk. And we tend to use a risk management process as opposed to a disciplinary process. But that risk management process can lead to their expulsion from sport. And in that case, would probably lead to a report to the DBS.
And if a party's not happy with the outcome of the concerns, how is that managed, Keith?
Within the risk management process and in the discipline process, if it did come to that, there's an appeal route through to our chairman, who sits with two other people, and the other two people could be other board members, but we encourage to go outside our sport and get independent members. And I think lots of sports now are helping each other, and they'll quite happily sit on an appeal panel for free, and you buddy up with other sports and you do it for each other.
So again, that cross sport working sounds really important.
Yeah,
do you have a similar appeals process, Nancy?
Yeah, so any appeals under our safeguarding procedure are considered by members of our disciplinary panel. We would have a panel of three members, so it would always be chaired by a barrister or senior lawyer, and then if they themselves are not child protection barristers or lawyers, then there must always be somebody else on the panel who works in safeguarding and brings that expertise. The appeal panel will meet to consider the case, but whether the appeal itself is heard on the papers or in person will depend on the nature of the case and the appeal. In my experience working with British Canoeing's appeal panel, and also in my previous role at England Golf, we did not have a shortage of volunteers. In fact, just huge numbers of volunteers, particularly with legal expertise, willing and ready to be involved. So I think if anybody's considering implementing something similar within their sport, then happy to talk with you further, but also I think you'll find it relatively easy to get people that are willing to share their expertise with you.
Well, that's good news and quite reassuring for those organisations who are still developing their appeals process. And Gordon, I know in boxing you have a relationship with Sport Resolutions. Can you tell us a little bit about how that works?
Both England Boxing can appeal and the accused can appeal. So an appeal process needs to be above that. So we use Sports Resolutions, and Sports Resolutions give complete independence. We just hand the case over to them. They appoint the panel and make a completely independent decision.
Yeah, and it's useful to know that Sport Resolutions is another option for governing bodies in terms of managing appeals. And we know that children, young people and families tend to get a bit lost when we are looking at case management processes. How do you make sure that they are consulted and kept informed about what's happening, Nancy?
It absolutely is a challenge, particularly where you have perhaps in the most significant of cases, a long period of time before actually as an organisation, we are taking any action. So if a case is with the police for investigation, we might impose an initial interim suspension, have some contact with the individuals, the families, and then it might be years until we're actually in a position to fully conduct a risk assessment if that investigation goes on for a long time. I think one of the challenges then maintaining meaningful contacts and updates with those individuals that are concerned when actually there isn't very much information to share. From our perspective, I think the ways that we try to manage that is firstly to try and build a good rapport with children and families from the start of the case. We've also established standard practice that we will update the people of concern, but also that the young people and families or any other interested parties in the case after every case management group meeting. So that's every 2 months. So even if there's been no developments, it's just a note to say the case management group's considered your case. There is no further action. But if you have any questions, then just to get in touch. So we will always have that standard 2 month update unless anyone's indicated that they don't want to hear from us that frequently. And then I think the other thing is trying to manage expectations on timescales. So I think for people to understand that sometimes it might be a long time until you're in a position to make a final decision and to explain the reasons for that. And then I think from our organisation, we do benefit from having a performance wellbeing coach. So if there are athletes that are affected by safeguarding cases within the Talent or World Class programme, that she's there as a support and will provide updates and will check in to see how they are on quite a regular basis. And I think that really helps link our work up in the department with supporting those young people.
That's great. And I think one of the things there to kind of come back to just to highlight was the thing around timescales, because it is so difficult for people who are not involved in safeguarding to appreciate how long these things take. And that must be very frustrating for all involved. So I don't know if you've got anything to add there, Keith.
Yeah, I think Nancy alluded to it. It's about managing expectations. So if it's a police investigation, but we've been involved in maybe suspending the coach, it's very much telling the person making the allegation or their parents, where it's appropriate, what the process will be, but making it quite clear that while there's a police investigation going on, I won't be doing anything whatsoever to do with that investigation, because it'll be just interfering in a police investigation. But then once I've got it, I keep quite close contact with them, and every new bit of information I get, I'll keep them updated.
Thank you. And Gordon, any additional comments from you on this question?
It's so important, but there's no formal process. It's down to the investigating officer being mindful of it and putting their own systems in. I think it is a difficult area, because when you focus on the investigation, sometimes that could be the bit that slips, that you're actually keeping important people up to date at all times.
Yeah, keeping everyone in mind is absolutely crucial. Now, we're all concerned with building safer cultures, and I'm thinking about how case management could support that. Nancy, I know you take case information to the board to provide senior leadership on safeguarding. How does that work?
I take an anonymised log of cases to each of our governance and risk committees. So the governance and risk committee is a subcommittee of our board, and it meets around 5 times a year. So that log doesn't provide obviously any of the personal information involved, but just give a number of the cases, the nature of that case, and the risk management measures in place, and then maybe any other areas that might be relevant to the board, such as media interest or reputational damage. And also perhaps if for example a case has been open for a long time, a bit of information as to why. And then the log also contains details as the time the case was last worked on, which I think is important for the board to feel confidence in cases being progressed in a timely and an efficient way. I think this is working pretty well in my experience. It's allowed for challenge from the board, and it's led to more discussion around process procedures and satisfaction of those that are involved. Another thing we have found has helped is our governance and risk committee meeting the case management group. So they last met about 18 months ago and are due to come along to our next case management group meeting. I think just having that discussion, just to understand, I guess, the roles, the focus of each separate groups, and I guess for the committee to understand from the safeguarding case management group, if there are areas where actually from their experience of managing cases, there is a need for the board to take more action, whether that's in terms of providing more resources to safeguarding or a greater commitment. And there's that opportunity for discussion. And I think that's been really helpful too.
Thank you. And finally, a question for all of you. What would you advise other sports organisations who are listening to this to ask that of Nancy first?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I recognise that resources are a challenge to lots of organisations, but I do think if to effectively manage cases and to prioritise safeguarding, there does need to be a role dedicated to safeguarding, or many roles, particularly to safeguarding case management, because there will always be conflicting priorities and other jobs to do. And I think to ensure that case management in the safeguarding remit is prioritised will allow those cases to be progressed and will allow those people affected by safeguarding case to have confidence that case will be properly managed, but also confident in the organisation's commitment to safeguarding. Another thing that I think is vital and doesn't need resource is to really take time to reflect on areas for improvement. I would say we learn something from every case, and whether that's, you know, improving how we communicate, how we record decisions, or how we share information and work with statutory agencies more effectively, I think there's always something we could do better.
Great. And Keith, you talked about some of the sharing with other organisations. Anything else you'd like to add in terms of a tip for other organisations listening to this?
I think really it's just important to make sure that your procedures are robust. And as Nancy says, just each time you have a case, you'll learn from it and think, OK, were my procedures fit for purpose for that? Perhaps they let us down on that. So revisit your procedures until you're really, really happy with them. Make sure that what you've got works for you and are legally correct. And then the vital one is follow them. You know, we will occasionally be challenged legally over some of our decision-making processes, but organisations will only find themselves in trouble if they didn't follow their procedures. And the other thing I think is important, that don't be intimidated by the term investigation. Don't be intimidated because you're being threatened with legal action. There's lots of friends out there that you can always talk to about any of the processes all the way through it.
That's great, Keith. Thanks. And Gordon, I don't know if Nancy and Keith have already covered your points, but anything you want to add there?
Yeah, I just think communication is quite important in the organisation, and people shouldn't be frightened or wary of reporting safeguarding concerns. We've got to think safeguarding, we're all working together. And if honest mistakes are made, we're not looking to punish people. We're looking to make things better in safeguarding.
That's a great message to leave us on in terms of what the purpose of case management is, in terms of making it better and making systems better. So a big thank you to Nancy, Keith and Gordon for providing us with an insight into your case management processes. It's important that these systems are in place in every governing body, and they need to be developed to suit your organisation and participants. Thank you for listening to this podcast, and please remember to check out the case management tool on our website, thecpsu.org.uk.
Thank you for listening to this Child Protection in Sport Unit podcast. If you're looking for more information and resources on safeguarding children in sport, please visit our website at thecpsu.org.uk.